Oh, yes, dear listener, spring is most definitely here. Now, there are some parts of the world where it's not exactly warm and fuzzy and wonderful in terms of the weather, and that includes here in the United States. There's still many places a shiver, 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 and there are some places where it is baking hot, such as climate change and global warming. I really hope that people do their part, and I hope that you also do your part and visit, with such a wild segue, the Politocrat Daily Podcast online store at the-politocrat.myshopify.com. Lots of items, t-shirts, beanies, hoodies, hats, masks. Oh my goodness me, there's so many things, I've forgotten half of them. And there are more coming. Please do yourselves a wonderful little favor and buy right now at the Politocrat Daily Podcast store. It is at the-politocrat.myshopify.com. Shop right now. Thank you. Welcome to the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It is Sunday, April the 4th, 2021. On this edition of the Politocrat, the UK is slipping away. Troubling, troubling, and very troubling things going on right now in the United Kingdom. What a game that was last night in the Men's National Championship semi-final, aka the Final Four on the NCAA. That's the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Men's college basketball. Whoa, what a game that was. That second game in the Final Four last night here in the United States between Gonzaga and UCLA was a classic. A classic game. My goodness me, I had picked UCLA to win, and I am not a fan of UCLA. I know they've had the storied history, the UCLA Bruins, the men's basketball team and college basketball, a storied history of winning national championships in the collegiate Division I level. John Wooten was their legendary head coach who took them to a number of national championship titles in the 60s and into the 1970s as well. I mean, just superb. Lou Alcindor, etc., etc., for those of you who know your college, men's college basketball in the U.S. And what a spectacular game last night. I think that John Wooten, had he still been alive, he died at the age of 99 a few years back, he would have been immensely proud of the Bruins, even though they lost. You just heard the audio there. Whoa, what a finish. That was the final few seconds of last night's game. And my goodness gracious me, you may not have heard all the mania, but the bottom line is that the game was 90-88 in overtime. Gonzaga, the number one team in the country who had not lost all season long, leading by two. UCLA with the ball. They're the number 11 seed who had to fight like hell just to get into the tournament. They were not expected to make the Final Four, at least everybody outside of the UCLA Bruins. Did not pick them to even be in the Final Four. And UCLA tie the game off of a miss to make it 90-90 with 3 seconds left in overtime last night. And everybody in the building and everybody watching, including yours truly, expected this to go to a double overtime. But there was still 3 seconds left on the clock. And my goodness me, up stepped Jalen Suggs of Gonzaga. And with just under 3 seconds left, he shot a ball from around the halfway line on the court. I mean, half court. And the ball was in the air and bank shot and in. 93-90. A 50-foot three-pointer from Jalen Suggs, who, by the way, had been holding his shooting hand, apparently had jammed it or hurt it. But my goodness me, when it came to winning that game with a prayer, he did just that with his shooting hand. And a dramatic buzzer-beating win in overtime for the Gonzaga Bulldogs. What a dramatic game that was. A classic all the way through, by the way. And a heartbreaking loss for UCLA. But UCLA, nothing to hold their heads down about here. They should hold their heads up high. And they have really done that franchise, that organization, really proud there. And that college, UCLA Bruins, wow. What a season they had in the men's college game. Congratulations to them on a really fine season. They obviously did not want it to end the way it did, but if it had to end in any way, this would have to be it. Not by them missing any points or any shots, not by them missing a free throw at the end, but by a buzzer beater. It took that kind of excellence to defeat UCLA last night. And wow, if you watched that game, I know whether you're a sports fan or not, you have to tip your hat to not only Gonzaga and to Jalen Suggs for hitting that half-court three-point shot, but you really have to tip your hat to UCLA as well. Both of these teams put on probably, I think, the best-played men's college basketball game in a Final Four in many years. I mean, it's got to be at least 2 decades. Or maybe ever. I can't think of a game that was played this well, at this level, at this kind of moment, because you had a Final Four game is a big deal. And if the championship game on Monday, tomorrow, between Baylor and Gonzaga is half as good as what we saw last night in that second game between UCLA and Gonzaga, we are in for a real treat. The audio there, you heard the voices of Jim Nance. I know this may not mean much to people who aren't followers of college sports in the U.S., but Jim Nance on CBS, and also Grant Hill, the Hall of Fame NBA basketball player, and Bill Raftery, the commentator who just has a great way with words. At the end there, you may have heard him say, "There are onions, Jim. And then there are major onions with a kiss." That's Bill Raftery, one of the great characters of the sports college basketball analytics team. He is a really good analyzer, and he just is really good with the way he intones. And his way with words is really funny and really amusing. So anyway, that's that. Also, I want to just say quickly, for the women's national championship game, which is taking place today, Stanford versus Arizona. That should be a really good one. I've got to say that, my goodness me, the University of Connecticut, UConn, who normally are in the championship game every year, were upset by Arizona. And as a result of that, Gino Auriemma, who gets his teams to a championship game, it seems, every season and wins almost all of them every season. They seem to win a national championship. Well, not this year. Pipped at the post in the Final Four, and now it's going to be Arizona v. Stanford today for the national championship for the women's collegiate game in the NCAA. Omar Moore here from the Politocrat Daily Podcast. And I really am urging you to take good care of your health. It is so important, especially now during a very difficult time. This pandemic, this global pandemic, is wreaking havoc. Please do not let your guard down. Make sure you wear a mask. Heck, wear two if you can. I mean, this is a critical time. And I know vaccinations are here and people are getting vaccinated, but that doesn't mean that you take your mask off. You still have to do the things you did before you got vaccinated. So please, please, dear listener, spread the word and make sure you yourself wear masks. Vaccinated or not, it's really important that you do so. Wear a mask, keep physically distant, and make sure you avoid large crowds. And wash your hands. Don't forget to do that as well. Thank you very much. Happy Easter to you all. I do want to start, before getting into the main event of the day, of the evening, is how do you think? How do you think? And how has this pandemic affected that? How has the pandemic that we are still living through affected the way you think? Not just about the way you think generally, but the way you think about your life specifically. I think that the answer to that question is going to be affected by what has happened in your life over these past 13, 14 months. I think it's going to be affected by whether or not there are people in your life who have been affected by this virus, i.e. they've caught this virus. Perhaps you may have caught this virus, this coronavirus 19, COVID-19. It may have been affected by the fact that you may have lost somebody during the course of this last year to this virus or to some other situation, health-wise or other life-wise, where something happens. I came across a post on Twitter from somebody who said that, and I think it was Dr. Seema Yasmeen, who can be seen on CNN. When I used to watch CNN, I would see her regularly. She actually is based not too far away from here, down in Stanford. I was just talking about Stanford a few minutes ago. And Dr. Seema Yasmeen is from London. And she was on Twitter the other day. I don't remember her Twitter handle. I would give that to you, so you could follow her, and I may yet still post that, but if I can find it. But I'm sure I can find it. I follow her. I should be able to find. But she had tweeted something the other day. She said, you know, someone I know, a good friend of mine, I'm paraphrasing the tweet, was walking along, tripped on a paving stone on the sidewalk, fell, and hit their head and died. And apparently they were fairly young, not that the age matters, but I'm just setting the scene. Was someone who was a doctor themselves, I think, in the medical profession or something, either a doctor or someone else in the medical profession, and had their whole career ahead of them and their whole life ahead of them and was a good person and there you go. There you go. How life comes to us. Some of us get this much rougher than others do. Much rougher than others. Excuse me. So how has life in this pandemic affected how you think about things? About your own life, about your own mortality, about the mortality of those that you love, the kinds of things that you can do and that you can't do, how you react to everything now, as opposed to say, a year and a half ago. Have you noticed the change? The reason why I throw these questions at you in a feverish manner is because it's just something I think that is good to take stock of. And I'm sure that you do that in your time, in your quiet time, or in your conversations with people that you love and care about. You know, with your spouse, with your family in general, or with close friends that you trust, confidants. I'm sure you have these kinds of conversations about what this pandemic has done to you or how it's affected the way you think about things, the way you react to things now, the way you carry on about your life. I've talked about how I observe things now as I walk around and as I take stock of life. And you see the people who are very careful about how they are moving about in the world, vis-a-vis, okay, they're wearing a mask and they're wearing two masks, or they're wearing a shield and they're wearing this and they're wearing that. And then you see other people who, as I've said many times, they just don't care. They're walking around without a mask on, walking around, and they're just talking into their phone, no mask, not even a mask nearby, not a mask on them. Then you've got people who have a mask on or by dangling by the side of their ear, by the side of their face, but they're on the phone. And then you've got joggers who are just jogging and they've got no mask on. And then you've got joggers and they jog right near you. Then you've got joggers who have no mask on, but they're sensible enough and sensitive enough to, oh, they see someone, then they move away from you and jog at least 6 to 12 feet away. And then you've got that jogger who has a mask on and is just jogging with a mask on, which is exactly what I do. I jog with a mask on. And it just takes time to get used to the breathing and the used to how you're breathing with the mask on as you run. But those examples that I offered up is just how people react to the situation that they are put in, not by their own doing, but by a global pandemic, which is still taking people's lives. Although the rate of death in a lot of countries has gone down. So I just wanted to just put that out there. And also, I want to correct something I said yesterday or the day before. I had said that the only countries now, I said this yesterday, that the only countries who really have this vaccine are the United States, the United Kingdom, and some European countries. And of course, that's not true. And it's incredible. I mean, I said it and I knew instantly, but did not correct it because I was just in a train of thought that I wanted to get to. So I take full stock and apologize to you, dear listener, for being crudely dishonest. Because, of course, this vaccine or the vaccinations have taken place all around the world, in the Far East, in some African, well, not any African countries, really. I mean, South Africa doesn't have this vaccine, to the best of my knowledge. You know, the African continent doesn't have it, really much of any vaccination at all going on there. I mean, nothing that I know of. And COVAX is an organization, and I talked to Dr. Campman about this, Professor Campman, a few months ago now, or a few weeks back, I think it was a couple of months ago now, about this, back in February. And COVAX is an organization that's trying to change that reality, but it's not happened yet. It's not happened at all yet, not the way it should, not even close. But Asian countries do have this vaccines, and there are other countries outside of Asia and outside of Europe and outside of the UK and outside of the United States. So not exactly correct what I said yesterday. And again, I take full responsibility and I apologize to you for the incorrect and incomplete information that I provided. What habits do you want to break? That's the other thing I want to ask you. What habits do you want to break? Let's just name one. Is there a habit that you want to break but have not broken yet? Here we are, it's Easter Sunday. It's the fourth day of the second quarter of 2021, the fourth day in. And I'm going to do this more. I'm going to continue to periodically check in and pose these questions to you about how you're feeling, how you're thinking, what kinds of habits are you finding yourself in, what kind of habits do you want to break. Maybe there's habits that you don't want to break. Maybe you're saying, I know this is bad, but I don't care. I'm going to do it anyway. Maybe that's how you feel. You're entitled to feel that way, of course. I'm just simply asking the question, if there is a habit you want to break, which habit is that that you so desperately want to break, but you have not yet done so? I really would like to get you to think about that for a few moments. Hey, dear listener, did you know this? Did you know this? If you're in the United States of America and you do not have any health coverage, by all means, make sure you sign up for healthcare.gov. So very important. It is the Affordable Care Act protections for healthcare. You can have affordable healthcare today. Sign up now. You've still got a few months to go, but don't wait a few months. Do this today. You know, you procrastinate, you put it off, and lo and behold, before you know it, there's only a day left to sign up. So make sure you don't wait. There's no time as good as this very moment to do this. So why not do it right now? Sign up at healthcare.gov. That's healthcare.gov. If you don't have any healthcare, you live in the United States, make sure you sign up right now. I care about your health. I do. I care about how you're feeling. I hope you're feeling well. I know it's a tough time. I know it's challenging. It's been one hell of a last 14 months for all of us in so many different ways. And if you know someone, whether it's yourself or anyone else, who doesn't have healthcare at all, please start with healthcare.gov. Sign up today. Thank you. Glenn Miller with Moonlight Serenade. Welcome back to this edition of the Politocrat Daily Podcast. Thank you very much indeed for listening on this Easter Sunday. Happy Easter Sunday to you all. If you celebrate it, if you don't, I just hope you have a good Sunday. I hope you're having a good day. I hope you're enjoying this Sunday as we go through here on the fourth day of April. By the way, this day does have a great deal of significance, of course, very sadly, because those of you who are attuned to history know that on April the 4th, 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. He was on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. And I do want to actually play this bit of audio for you from Dr. King himself.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. Yes, I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country. Maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say we aren't gonna let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't gonna let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
That was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And that was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April the 3rd, 1968. Less than 24 hours later, he would be dead. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I talked about, I've talked many times about 1968 being probably the most consequential year in the history of the United States. And the United States is 244 years old. It will be 245 years old exactly 3 months from today, April 4th to July 4th is 3 months. And in 3 months' time exactly, it will be 245 years old. But I do think that 1968 was the most consequential year in the history of the United States of America, of these 244 plus years. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., sadly, horrifically, assassinated on this day back in 1968. It was this, as if he knew that this was going to happen to him, as a lot of black leaders did in that day. Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X particularly knew. He talked about it often in one of his books, or certainly in his speeches to the press. He knew as well, whether in his speeches or even to the press, he knew that his days were numbered, and Dr. King did too. One of the things, that Dr. King said there, you heard him, I may not get there with you. He knew. And it's so sad. You know, we have these really great people, good people, who care about the people they fight for. who care about humanity, who are cut down in the prime of their life, or at any time in their lives, cut down in the prime of their lives. And people are going to say, well, he did this, he did that. Look, he cared about people and he fought for them all his life and didn't make a red cent off of it, unlike some people now. These people who were cut down in the 60s, they didn't make any money off of activism. They didn't make a dime off of this. They left their families for years. Dr. King didn't spend all the time he wanted to spend with his family. Malcolm X didn't get to spend all the time he wanted to with Dr. Shabazz and his six daughters. Actually, at the time, Dr. Shabazz was pregnant with twins when Malcolm was assassinated in 1965. He was fighting to better a nation, better a planet, and better black people. That's what Malcolm was doing. That's what Martin was doing. Medgar Evers was doing. They weren't making money off of activism, unlike some folk now in the Black Lives Matter movement or some people in organizations. Got book deals. They got this. They got that. They're on panels, speaking engagements. I'm not saying that people shouldn't get those, but you've got to ask yourself, what are you in this for? Are you in this to fight for your people, or are you in this to make some money off of that fight? I'm not saying that you can't have a book deal. I'm just saying, if you're holding yourself out to be this freedom fighter, then we don't need to see you on all of these retreats doing speeches. You can make as many speeches as you want, but you just have to be clear with people what your real objective is. Dr. King left no doubt. And what a very sad day this is. It's an Easter Sunday that does have this sadness, and for his family, Dr. King's family, every year that they get to April 4th on the calendar, it is a very painful, painful day in particular for them, and every day after that. And they say that time heals all wounds, but does it? Do you think it does? One of the things in that piece of audio you just heard that I find striking that does not get played whenever they do play this speech on corporate news TVs is the part where he talks about somewhere I read that there was a right to freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read there was a right to protest. Somewhere I read that these were rights protected in the Constitution. And that's what he was talking about. And he talked about China. He talked about Russia and how those nations, totalitarian nations like those, weren't offering those things to people. So it wouldn't have been an outrage or much of a surprise to find that in China, there is these crackdowns, these totalitarian behaviors. And in Russia, there were these totalitarian behaviors and still are. And you've got dictators running amok in both of those places. And no matter how many nice suits they have on, no matter how many smiles they flash at the camera, both of those nations still have dictators running them. And there's still a lot of human rights violations in both nations. And so Dr. King was talking about that. That part of his speech where he talks about at the end, I've been to the mountaintop, it doesn't matter. When they play that in corporate news media and on your TVs, when you watch, because I know a lot of people who listen are people who watch the CNNs and the MSNBCs or the Sky Newses, and I watch Sky News. That's the only one I will watch. Or the BBC or your ITV or your Channel 4. Whenever they play that speech, or wherever you are in the world, whenever they do play that speech, that one from April 3rd of 1968, the day before, the night before Dr. King would be assassinated on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in 1968, they would never play you the part where he says, somewhere I read that there's freedom of assembly and all those things. Why do you think that is? I mean, I have my ideas as to why they don't play that part of the speech, and they only play the I've been to the mountaintop part. They never play the part about Russia or China and about, well, here in America, you know, somewhere I read there was freedom of assembly and we have a right to protest in this country, which we still do in the US of A. We have a right to protest. But here's my segue. In the United Kingdom, the right to protest is being eviscerated right before your eyes. And it does not make for very good reading at all. There has been a bill that has passed through a second reading in the House of Commons. It's not yet law. But this is a huge issue in the United Kingdom. In my native country, in the UK, well, you know, in England is my native country, but the UK is my native country. Made up of four nations. England, Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. And I'm telling you right now, in England, it is not looking good. There's a lot of trouble in the UK with this draconian law that could become law. It's a bill at the moment. And there have been demonstrations in all parts of England in particular around this legislation that, if passed, will outlaw protest in the United Kingdom. I'm dead serious. I am dead serious. And so Dr. King, in that audio you heard from April the 3rd, 1968, just a few hours before he would be killed, assassinated, talking about we have the right to protest in the United States, well, that's not so true necessarily anymore in the United Kingdom. Whatever protest that we have left in the UK could well slip away. And that's the focus of this episode. And I'm going to get into that some more right after this. Dear listener, become a dear subscriber right now to the brand new Politocrat Daily Podcast newsletter. You get benefits for your subscription in this subscription-only newsletter where you must pay in order to get the full benefit of everything. There are no freebies here. But dear listener, you will be glad you subscribed to become a dear subscriber to the Politocrat Daily Podcast newsletter. For your monthly subscription of $5, literally $5 a month, or a yearly subscription of $50 every year, you get exclusive special offers and discounts on all merchandise at the Politocrat Daily Podcast store, and you get a gift mailed to you during the course of a month or a quarter. I'm telling you now, that's just part of your benefit as a subscriber. You get audio extras you will not hear even on the episodes of this daily podcast, the Politocrat Daily Podcast, or anywhere else from yours truly. You'll get news stories that I have discussed and in-depth essays and articles from yours truly, exclusive to subscribers like yourself. Random mailings of free gifts, as I said, and lots more. And by the way, if you become a founding member, your subscription, which would be slightly higher than the yearly subscription, you get to set that price, by the way. You will get 4 books a year mailed to you. 4 books in one calendar year mailed to you. Not all at once, but they'll be mailed to you. And that's what founding members are and mean to me, yours truly, Omar Moore, here at the Politocrat Daily Podcast. And this newsletter is going to knock your socks off. Every day you're going to get a newsletter, which makes the price even more of a steal for you. So sign up right now for a paid subscription. It's subscribers only at the Politocrat Daily Podcast newsletter. You will love your benefits. It is definitely worth it. So go now to politocrat.substack.com and thank you for your subscription. Procol Harum, a whiter shade of pale. And welcome back. You know, oh boy. The United Kingdom is... Look, let's start with this. The UK has a lot of blood on its hands. Can we just start there? Can I just bluntly just start with that? You know, there's a great book that I am... hearing a lot of good things about that I can't wait to get my hands on. And it's called Empire Land. And it's written by last name Sanghera, S-A-N-G-H-E-R-A. I'll put the full link to it up. And it's about colonialism, and it's about how the UK and how so-called Great Britain, as it was called, and some people still call it that, but I don't know what's so great about it when you're talking about colonizing 3/5 of the planet and enslaving people and taking their land and killing them. And I don't know what's so great about all that, but there you go. As someone from the UK saying that. But again, my ancestors, my great ancestors were taken from the African continent and brought, you know, to... the UK, and then there's the Caribbean, and then there's the, you know, the United States. But the United Kingdom, who, again, in this history of violence and bloodshed and colonialization and imperialism, is we know it's rampant. We know it, right? And it's just the biggest theft of a planet has been done by the British. I have got no problem saying it. I'm from England. I'm British. I was born and raised there, grew up there. You know, I have no problem saying that because that's the history. And nobody should have a problem saying what the history is. And oh, I'm British. I can't face up to that. Well, you have to. You have to face up to it. The British are the most bloodthirsty, vicious bunch of criminals historically that the world has ever seen. Yes, I'm being blunt, I'm being crude, I'm being brutally honest. It's not even a question of being crude, actually. It's the truth. And I wasn't taught that in school in England. I had to learn that on my own. I had, thanks to my dad, books that I read from an early age that laid out the truth right in front of me when I was old enough to read them and understand them. And then I purchased books of my own, and then I read and I educated myself, as did many of you, or some of you listening later on did. And a lot of people still don't realize this about the UK. A lot of blood on the hands. And you say that now in certain parts of England in particular, and they will look at you as if they want to kill you. Or they will say, well, what are you doing in the country then? Get out. If you don't like it, get out. Some people will say that to you, by the way. But thankfully, there's a generation of people in England who aren't taking this mess and who are standing up. Hence the demonstrations and protests last year, toppling statues. People in England, black and white alike, certainly black people knew this, but you've got a growing white population of a new generation who are understanding very clearly about England and the UK in general and its colonial status and how it colonized all these countries and stole their land, killed many millions of people, got rid of leaders on the African continent like Patrice Lumumba and many others, were behind all of those things, installed dictators. I mean, come on. England was behind this. The UK was behind this. The British were behind this. It's a fact. And where did the royal family get all these jewels from? Hello, African continent. That was never taught to me. I've said this story before to you. The reason why I use this or engage in this preamble is to get to the karma question. Because now in the UK, you have a bill that is the subject of a lot of scrutiny, and rightly so, where you now have a bill that if it gets passed in the House of Commons, is going to make protest obsolete in the UK. It will absolutely put a chilling effect on protesting. It will be all very subjective and arbitrary. When someone can protest, can they protest? How? If it is a public annoyance? I am just reading things, paraphrasing them from this actual bill, which actually says that something that is annoying, highly annoying or annoying to society, is a protest that is going to be banned and criminalized. So this is completely arbitrary and capricious. It's on a whim. So if you don't like the fact that a Black Lives Matter group is protesting, you call the police. The police come, they see the protest, and they would be there anyway, but they see the protest and they say, right, it's a public annoyance. We've had a phone call here from a member of the public. It's an annoyance. Or even before that, you could just have people going, oh, this is annoying. A police officer could just say, this is annoying, you're a nuisance, you're a public nuisance and an annoyance. Bye. If you don't disperse, you're going to be put in handcuffs. Oh, how totalitarian of you. Speaking of Dr. King talking about Russia and China, he should have added the UK, because that's where the UK is going. And in some ways, it's always been there. If you look back at the 1960s and the Mangrove trial, into the 1970s, when police would just come to Black businesses in London and elsewhere, but particularly in London, that's where the Mangrove case came from, and they would just arrest for nothing. They would just totally arrest, and it was based on the fact that they hated Black people. So you'd have all these white male metropolitan police officers raiding a business, destroying it, destroying the business, and handcuffing the occupants. No, they didn't do anything wrong. They just ran their business like every other person runs their business. But no, we're going to just handcuff you. The Metropolitan Police would literally just throw Black people in prison. I mean, they would handcuff them, take them to the station, they'd beat them. They'd destroy the businesses that they owned. This is all happening in London in the 1960s and 70s. There was a whole trial about this called the Mangrove Trial. And for the most part, there were people in that trial. And this is happening around the time that the Chicago 7 trial was happening here in the US, except just maybe a year or two after. And the whole issue, a few short years after, the whole thing was is that a lot of the Black people on trial in the Mangrove trial in London defended themselves, didn't have attorneys. They went pro bono, at least a certain a few of them did. I mean, Darcus Howe is one of them, and a major figure in activism in London, in the UK. And, you know, they were all saying, look, you know, you are violating my human rights. These police who come in here and smash up our businesses, destroy our products, you know, arrest everybody and call us racist things. You can't do this. This is a society that is supposedly one that deals with everyone having a life to live, not to be interfered with by the state. And you know, those arguments were made, and they ended up winning the day for the most part. I think Dawkus Howe may not have been successful. I don't remember the exact outcome for him, but everybody else pretty much were successful in their arguments in this manner. I don't even remember what all the specifics are. It's been a long time. And I know that there was a movie called Small Axe that Steve McQueen directed. He directed, of course, 12 Years a Slave, and directed Widows, and directed Hunger, and a film called Shame. Those are the movies that that he directed. I'm trying to think if I left any out, but I can't think of any that I have left out. But if I have, you can let me know at politocratpod@gmail.com. And so, in the film Small Axe, which is an anthology actually of five different movies that came out last year, this mangrove, as far as I know, this mangrove, and I did watch the movie, it's just been a little while since I watched it, it was chronicled in the movie as well, in the movie Small Axe, and it was one of the five chapters of the movie, of the multiple films. You have to watch that too, by the way, to get an understanding of this, or just read about it. There have been books written about mangrove. And this was happening, so this is not the first time. This particular bill is really representative of what's been going on in England in particular for a number of decades, particularly against black people, for over a century, you know? And now we're beginning to see what the Conservative Party are doing. And it's so clear. We've been seeing it now for decades. Decades. Cut back on police. And of course, police are not everybody's best friend. And it's well known that the Conservative Party, aka the Tories, for the last 11 or 12 years have cut back on the number of police, have cut down on their budget, all kinds of things. And now, just as there are voter suppression laws being passed all over the United States, this particular bill is a real problem in the UK. It's a real problem. So much so that you've got conservatives even, some of them, raising real concerns about this bill. Labour Party people are raising concerns. Green Party people, I mean, the Green Party that has some integrity, unlike the Green Party here in the US, raising concerns. I mean, all over the political map, there are people who are coming out against this bill, and that this bill is really, really, really draconian. This is something that if you thought that the Metropolitan Police breaking up a peaceful vigil last month was something, was a problem, it's going to make that, this bill will make that look like child's play. Then this bill will give police all kinds of powers that they do not need. And there have been demonstrations all over the country, from John O'Groats to, you know, Land's End. I'm telling you, people are not having this. It's very dangerous. And Bristol in particular has been a hot spot for demonstrations and protests. There's been some unrest during some of those protests. Police have been instigating a lot of it. There have been some clashes. This is a real problem, this particular bill. And I'm going to link to some of this stuff and some of the articles around it. Here's something I just want to read. In a free and democratic society, the right to protest in public is fundamental, and the presumption in favor of maintaining that right, even at the risk of its being occasionally abused, is paramount. The criticisms of this part of the bill from many quarters should not be ignored, even as we ask critics to face up to new policing challenges. The bill, being so wide in its scope, also deals with many other issues unrelated to public order and demonstrations. Those voting against it at second reading, as the official opposition apparently intends to do, must explain and justify their doing so, when there will be much in it that their constituents will want. Now, this language I've just read was written on March, or published on March the 16th of this year. So that was just last month, 2021, March of last month, of this year, just last month, by none other than the uber conservative, I call him a libertarian, Steve Baker, or as he's nicknamed by some in the English press, Steve Hardman Baker, the conservative MP from Buckinghamshire, which is just about, what, 35 miles, maybe a little less than that, north of London, outside London, probably a little bit less than 35 miles. I think it's a lot less than 35, might be 20 miles. But anyway, Buckinghamshire is just neighboring to Hertfordshire. For those of you who don't know your geography, in the south of England. So anyway, Steve Baker is a very conservative person. I call him a libertarian. And he's somebody who is a Brexiteer, someone who is pro-Brexit, and Brexit's not strong enough, it's not punishing people enough. And even he is joining in with, this law is draconian, because the UK does not have an official constitution. They have a constitution, but it's one that's not written. It's one that's done based on an honours system. So technically there is a constitution based upon the course of dealing in the honours system way. We trust that you will not do this. We trust that you will not do that. We trust that you will instead do this and you will instead do that. That's how the UK constitution works, by practice. Whereas here in the United States, there's a constitution that's actually written. And that's what we point to here. The amendments, the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments of the US Constitution. We point to the Declaration of Independence, which is the Declaration of Independence. We point to the Articles of Confederation. We point to all these things. And what we have now in the UK is a very dangerous bill. And if you've got Steve Hardman Baker, an ultra-conservative and basically a libertarian, telling you that this bill is a mess and is a real problem, is problematic, that should tell you just how severe the bill is. And he was joined by Dominic Grieve. Now, Dominic Grieve is more of a moderate conservative. Now, in this country, Dominic Grieve would probably be a Democrat. And I'm not talking a moderate Democrat. Dominic Grieve of the UK would be in the US a Democrat. Probably a blue dog Democrat, or if not that, just a Democrat, not even a Bernie Sanders independent, and not a progressive perhaps, but he would be a middle of the road Democrat in the United States. No question. The ways that people are conservative in, say, the UK or in France or in Germany, and the way they're democratic is very different than it is here in the United States. Very different. So, Dominic Grieve used to be in Parliament. He was kicked out of Parliament, really, by Boris Johnson when the whip was withdrawn from him. And I think he ended up just walking away from it all. I don't think he ran again. He didn't stand again for election. And he was out. And so the two of them, Dominic Grieve used to be the Attorney General, by the way, in England, in the UK. And, you know, there were certainly some rocky seas for him when he was the Attorney General in the UK. But to see that both of these individuals, who are on opposite sides of Brexit, by the way, Dominic Grieve was a Remainer. He was someone who believed that the United Kingdom should remain in the European Union, that they should absolutely stick to their guns and stay there. And Steve Baker was a Brexiteer. And wanted the toughest Brexit possible. The one that would cripple jobs. The one that would send jobs elsewhere. The one that would keep out anybody who made a living traveling from EU countries into the UK and back. And he got that pretty much. And Brexit now is not heard from anymore. But Brexit has been a disaster, as I've told you on this podcast. Polly Toynbee's article in The Guardian a few weeks back talking about the failure of Brexit, and that no one in the press is talking about it except Polly Toynbee and a few others. And other than that, you're not hearing a darn thing about Brexit anymore because it's failing. and the right-wing press in England that propped up Brexit throughout the time from 2016 when the referendum first came in to the very day that Boris Johnson celebrated arms aloft, fist pumped, with Union Jacks behind him, or I should say Union flags behind him, because the Union Jack is not such until it is affixed to a boat or a ship. If you have a Union flag, it is a flag that's not attached to a vessel. It's called the Union flag. People don't know, don't realize that, some people. And the flag for the UK is the Union Jack when it is affixed to, I think, a flagpole on a building, or maybe not, or certainly on a ship for sure and on a boat. That's when it's called the Union Jack. But elsewhere, otherwise, it's called the Union flag. The four nations. The white is for Scotland. The red is for England. The red is for England. The blue is for Scotland. I think the white is for Wales. And Northern Ireland, I'm not so sure if theirs also has white in it, their flag. Because if you look at their flag, I think they have white in their flag too. Scotland has white and blue. But anyway, that's a whole nother thing. And someone can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm doing that from memory about what the colors in the Union flag are. But the point is that Dominic Grieve against Brexit, Steve Baker for it, Brexit no longer on the radar. And this is part of what I think is a larger thing that is making the United Kingdom less welcoming and more hostile. Brexit has made life very difficult for people, very difficult for businesses in the UK, and it's made it harder for people who travel from EU countries to work in England and then travel home. It's made it very, very difficult. A lot of things going on, a lot of tariffs, a lot of paperwork, a lot of nightmares that aren't being covered at all in the English press. Certainly not by the right-wing press that had been cheerleading Brexit all along. And Brexit, all it has done is resulted in people who are very rich, Crispin O'Day, the businessman, and others, like Nigel Farage, no longer in politics, he says. It results in them making billions of pounds. Billions of pounds. There's pictures of Nigel Farage posing next to a crashing stock market. And a big shit-eating grin on his face. Because he knows money is being made. He's making money off of this Brexit referendum. In 2016, you can see it. There's a picture of him. I've posted this on Twitter at the Popcorn REEL many times. A picture of him smiling and grinning at the stock market going down in England. And this is on the night of the Brexit referendum in June 23rd of 2016. He was happy and gleeful. And then a few hours later, he would get up and be celebrating about our Independence Day. And it's not, it's your money-making day is what it was. But you see, I think all these things are connected. So now you've got Brexit, which is crippling businesses in England and in the UK overall. It's crippling movement, freedom of movement between EU nations and the UK. It's not a good thing. It's been horrible for people in port cities like Kent and areas like that. You know, Dover. I mean, this is nightmarish. Nightmarish. Then you got this bill, you know, that has passed in a second reading. The article I read to you that was written by Steve Baker and Dominic Grieve, the portion of it I read to you, was written on March 16th, as I said, before the second reading of the bill was passed. And it was passed in the House of Commons, but that doesn't mean that the law is passed yet. It's not a law yet. There's going to be a third reading pursuant to the House of Commons and a measure there that allowed there to be a third reading. And if it gets the votes I'm telling you, it's going to be a problem. It's going to be a real problem in the United Kingdom. And not only that, you've got other issues going on there. With this bill is a real problem. I will be supplying some links and things. This is a real problem. You won't be able to protest. This will be a totalitarian country. The UK will be a fascist nation. And like myself and others have said that it has been that way actually for many years, but now you're seeing it really bear its ass to you. Or as they say in my native country, bearing its ass to you. Because that's what Boris Johnson and these conservatives are doing right now. They're bearing their ass. And they're showing you that they haven't wiped it. That's how disgusting this gets with this disgusting bill that will curtail the rights of people to peacefully assemble. This is how a right-wing takeover looks. This is how a fascist takeover begins. This is how a conservative Tory right-wing takeover happens. The UK has been lurching rightward for a long time, and I'm telling you, it's really happening now. People felt that, well, after Thatcher had been run out of office, that was going to stop. But it just slowed down with Tony Blair. I'm not even talking about John Major. That's a whole in effect. John Major just, as a prime minister, oh dear. But I'm talking Labour. When we got to Tony Blair, people who thought that this right-wing lurch wouldn't continue were wrong, because we still kept going right. Even with this so-called New Labour Party. New Labour was a neoliberal party. And I don't mean that in, ooh, lefty. I mean that in, oh, globalism. Oh, let's continue to corporatize things and we'll give you guys, the crumbs, but a few more crumbs while we keep pushing this thing right. And that's what happened. And then you had David Cameron. And then his bright idea to call up a Brexit referendum. Let's just do it. Yeah, I mean, there are people in my party who are shouting loudly. Let me just listen to them. Instead of putting his Bose noise-canceling headphones on and proceeding with the order of the day and the order paper in the House of Commons, David Cameron refused to put on his Bose. I know, I'm plugging Bose. Noise-canceling headphones. And instead decided, yeah, okay, referendum, I'm calling you bluff. And so those loud, noisy people in his back benches in the Conservative Party in the House of Commons rang his bell and he listened and he picked up and said, how do you do? Okay, I'm going to give you your freaking referendum. And he gave it to them and they won. 52-48, I think. And everybody knows it was fraudulently procured. Everybody knows that. But who cares, right? Because what happened was, is it was the beginning of trouble. Or maybe the middle of it. It was not the end of it. It was just the start. And then you had this 4 years of division and rancor and bitterness, 4.5+ years. You couldn't get the blooming thing done. Get Brexit done. Boris Johnson conned the people. People were not informed about what was going on. It was a nightmare. Everything was just not good. And look what's happened. What do you see for your Brexit now, dear Englander? What do you see? Where's your Brexit? What's it got for you? What's it conjured up for you? What good has it been for you? Those of you who have voted for it. Those of you who voted for it. What has it done for you? Huh? Where's the goodness in Brexit? And then it begets this kind of garbage. This draconian law. Very, very dangerous indeed. So those women who were thrown to the ground in handcuffs. I talked about the black women in Alabama. Well, I'm talking about them now. I've talked about them in the past, I should say. Black women with knees on their neck in Alabama. just like George Floyd. You thought that those protests last month, peaceful vigil and protests in Clapham Common down there in South London were something, with the police throwing women down to the ground, handcuffed, knees on their backs, in their backs. You thought that was something? 5 foot nothing woman thrown down, white woman just shoved to the ground, any woman shoved to the ground. You thought that was a problem? Wait till this bill, if this bill ever passes and becomes law, say goodnight to the UK as you know it. We've already kind of said halfway goodnight to it anyway with this Brexit. It's going to have an irreparable effect. And it already is Brexit. And this law, this police bill, this act, whatever it's called now, I don't know what the hell the name of it is. It's just disgraceful. It will make, well, it might even make Bull Connor blush. And I don't think that's even possible. Hard to imagine that could ever happen. This is a guy that went around with his nightstick, or as we say in England, truncheon, and started beating people. Police Commissioner of Birmingham, Eugene Bull Connor, would bring his dogs and sick them on black folk, get the water hoses on them. Bull Connor was a piece of garbage and a racist at the same time. A piece of garbage, this guy. A racist, he was violent. Police Commissioner of Birmingham. And I think this bill, maybe I'm going a little bit too far there, but if he were alive and he looked at this bill and he was not aware that this was from England, he might have asked, what country is this from? He might have asked, oh, I guess that's, he might have just said, that's Russia, that's China, or that's some other totalitarian place. Maybe he might say we could put this into place in Alabama. Maybe that's what he would say. I don't know. Maybe he'd blush. Maybe he wouldn't. Maybe he'd say, right on. Can we put this into place? But this bill, oh my God, it's a nightmare. No protesting. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't have a picket sign. You can't do this. If you speak too loud, if you're too many people in the gathering, you can't, you can't, you can't, you can't. If we deem this an annoyance, I mean, that's awfully broad. What's an annoyance? That's broad, that's vague. It could be anything. If I shout that my football team has won a match, and I shout that in the middle of the high street in a town in London somewhere, that's an annoyance to someone, and that could be deemed antithetical to the law. I could get arrested for that. Under this bill, I could be arrested. I mean, that's how draconian this thing is, and I'm not exaggerating. We have got to fight back, and the way we do that, dear listener, those of you in England and those of you anywhere else, but particularly in the UK, in England and elsewhere in the UK, is to write to your MP or email your MP or tweet your MP or request a COVID, you're not going to have meetings directly, a Zoom meeting with your MP. And talk to your MP, Member of Parliament, about how you feel about this bill. And tell your MP, please, do not vote for this bill. You've got an election coming up. See, here's another thing that I didn't mention. I've mentioned it before, but not here so far. You've got local elections, all over the United Kingdom beginning or only on Thursday, May the 6th. That's just over 2 months from now. All over the nation, all over the United Kingdom, there are going to be elections held. Hundreds of elections for the way that Parliament will look after that date. All of these seats are up for grabs in the House of Commons, in the Parliament, in Westminster and beyond. And you've got the Scottish National Party, you've got the Scottish Labour Party, the Scottish Conservatives, you've got the Green Party, you've got the Labour Party, you've got the Conservatives, you've got the Lib Dems, Liberal Democrats, who really are almost a non-existent party now. Ed Davey now, the head of the Lib Dems once again after Joe Swinson got sensationally knocked out of the box, if you will. She just got hammered in her race for holding her seat up in Scotland, where she's from. And do you remember that from 2019? The news that came in while the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon of the Scottish National Party, had been on camera waiting for an interview that she's going to do a live remote for. And the camera was on her. And there was the news that came in over the loudspeaker where she was in the hall where they were doing the election count for her race or for someone else's. And she was there and she had obviously coasted in her race. So it was a matter of finding out how her party was doing elsewhere. And the news came in that Joe Swinson had been defeated by one of the Scottish National Party candidates up in Scotland to take Joe Swinson's seat. And you saw it. Oh, and I remember I watched it live. Nicola Sturgeon pumping her fists and going, yes, oh my God. It was one of the most genuinely purest, like genuinely open, not purest, it's generally open, honest moments I've seen from a politician in many a year, particularly in Scottish or British politics. I mean, oh my God. That was raw and open and honest. And I like Nicola Sturgeon. I think she's a great politician. I know some people think that she has not done her job right, that she's got some issues. The whole mess with Alex Salmond, which is a big mess. You know, Alex Salmond now is running his own party. How convenient. You know, this is a guy who was charged with rape and sexual harassment. Now, he was cleared of the charges in court. And now he's starting Scottish Independence Party. Just in time for the May 6th elections. How convenient. The Alba Party, ALBA, as in Jessica Alba, spelt the same way. Alba Party. Not as in her, but as in her last name. Alba, ALBA. It's just unbelievable. The political scene in the UK now is just whoa. And when you've got Conservatives, and when you've got Labour people, both of whom express such severe objections to this very dangerous bill, that means it is a very dangerous bill. And you've got Keir Starmer, campaigning all over England, and in Scotland too, for Labour. And Labour got their butts handed to them in 2019, as I have chronicled on this podcast, and I've also had guests on talking about that in the past. We've had these conversations here. And Labour, if you can believe it, are struggling, and I hate polls, but they're struggling in the polls. As of last few months, the Conservatives were still leading in the polls. And I think part of the reason why is the vaccinations. That's one of the biggest reasons why. The party in power is going to benefit from that, just like Joe Biden, President Biden, is benefiting from that after the train wreck of the last 4 years that we had with the other guy who didn't care if you died and basically said, you know, you guys can go to hell and F off. That's what he said to you. It was like Ford to New York City dropped dead, except it was Trump to America dropped dead. And Joe Biden, President Biden, as I talked about yesterday, has benefited from, you know, really, it's not just because of him, but his team and everybody, because over 150 million people now have been vaccinated in the UK and US since January 20th, when he walked into the White House. And he's going to surpass 200 million people before we get to April 29th, which is 100 days of his office. So I just mentioned that. And in the UK, the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is benefiting, and the Conservative Party that he belongs to are benefiting from the increase in vaccinations. There has been a pretty darn good job done by the UK in that respect. You have around 29 million to 30 million people, if not more, who have been vaccinated at least with one shot, at least. That's a tremendous result. Even though there are issues with AstraZeneca, there's a back and forth about the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, the fact that it has caused blood clots in some people, that there still, though, is a tremendous, robust use of the vaccination for people in the UK, despite that, where it has caused some issues in a few cases, not widespread, but enough to cause some concern amongst some. But Boris Johnson and the Conservatives still manage to be popular, and they've still got a large majority. And I want to see how this plays out on the political landscape, because you've got the vaccinations on the one hand, and on the other hand, you've got this draconian bill that Boris Johnson supports. You've got this vaccine passport situation that Boris Johnson also supports. And is trialing, they are trialing this with the FA Cup final, the Football Association Cup final. That's football in England, English football, that's coming up next month. They're actually going to trial this, so they're going to let some fans in, and they can only be let in if they have a vaccination passport. I mean, this is really horrendous. This is going to invite so much discrimination. It's going to be discriminatory. It is inherently discriminatory. What you should instead be doing is requiring people to show proof of vaccination with two pieces of ID. One, an actual vaccination card, which you get obviously once you're vaccinated, and a note from a doctor specifying and certifying that. And I get it, people can fake notes, but I'm talking about having a phone number and contact information for a doctor and having that registered with that doctor so that when that doctor is contacted or emailed or called, they can verify that at a moment's notice in a database. That's what happens. I mean, look, when you sign up for all these things and you're doing it online, your information is being put in a medical company's database. I mean, if you're insured, you are in a database. If you have health insurance and you put that information in, you've got a medical record number. And if you're in the NHS, you've got an NHS membership, National Health Service in England. You've got a membership. You are in a database. Why does Boris Johnson need to do vaccination passports? I don't care whether people in polls agree with it or they don't. A lot of people say a lot of crap in polls. Polls mean nothing. I keep saying this. I've had enough of these polls. They are done to influence public opinion. They are not done to do anything else. And I don't care whether more people like it or they don't. It's a small sample size. The reality is that this discriminates. And it's another problem with what's going on in the UK. You've got a report that came out last week from the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities that said that racism isn't a factor anymore, that racism is not a huge problem in the United Kingdom anymore. I mean, that's just unbelievable. This is not the issue anymore. Racism is not really the factor. I'm going to link this 258-page report. Came out on the last day of March of this year. 31st of March 2021, the UK government's Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities. And it's a despicable report. It's dishonest. Oh, the UK is not a racist country. This is a dishonest report. And it's an infamously disgraceful one. So you've got that. You've got this draconian bill that if it's passed, you won't be able to freaking well protest in the UK anymore, in England anymore. You got Brexit that's crippling the country, but no one wants to talk about it, except Polly Toynbee and a few others. You've got a Labour Party that's still trying to find itself, Sir Keir Starmer. I don't know why he has not made more hay about what's going on. You got Jeremy Corbyn and the whole mess with him. He's no longer in the Labour Party as a member sitting in terms of voting. He can't vote with Labour in the House of Commons. He cannot. He's had the whip removed and he has not had it reinstated. And he's at this protest and he's calling for people to get in the streets. Listen, I'm going to play you this bit of audio from Jeremy Corbyn. This was from earlier. Actually, this I think was recorded at the end of March. But I'm going to play this to you. This is just, you've got to listen to this. This is about 90 seconds from Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader, who is now no longer in the Labour Party as a voting member because he's had the whip withdrawn, which means he's been taken from the party. He doesn't have the parliamentary whip, which means he cannot participate as a member of Labour in the debates in the House of Commons. When question time comes, he cannot participate as a Labour member. He would be sitting as an independent, basically. Just the way that Kenneth Clark was when he was had the whip withdrawn from him by Boris Johnson a couple of years ago, or last year, the year before, for the Conservatives. And then he ended up leaving politics anyway. He's now a Lord. He's now Lord Clark in the House of Lords. So he's still, I guess, in politics, but he's left the House of Commons. He's now in the House of Lords. But here's what Jeremy Corbyn had to say. I believe it was either the end of March or the April 1st of this year, one of the two. And the protests are called Kill the Bill. Hashtag Kill the Bill. And there's a reason why it's called that. Here's what Jeremy Corbyn had to say just a few days ago. You've got to listen to this.
The right to protest is precious. Protest movements make history. From the 8-hour working day to the vote for women to the right to equal pay, the rights we take for granted had to be won through protest. We took them. They weren't handed to us by the rich and powerful. From opposing apartheid to the Iraq War, I'm proud to have protested against injustice and defended the right to protest itself. That right, which gives a voice to those often unheard, is once again under threat from a dangerous bill, which effectively criminalizes peaceful protest. Just this month, we saw a vigil attacked by the police, not even a protest, a dignified remembrance moment for the horrific murder of Sarah Everard. The Conservatives now want the right to ban any protest, simply because they deem it a nuisance, or using their words, annoying. Annoying the powerful is not a crime. And I'll tell you something, we're annoying them this week. There's been a surge of resistance to this bill that they weren't expecting, because the right to protest is at the heart of a democratic society. It's part of who we are. And together, we'll beat Boris Johnson's dangerous proposal to ban protest.
That was Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader, and he is an MP still at Islington North in North London, but he is no longer a member of the Parliamentary Labour Party. He has had the whip removed from him by Sir Keir Starmer regarding the comments around a report around anti-Semitism and the things that he said, and I've spoken about that on this podcast in the past. But on this occasion, Jeremy Corbyn's absolutely correct. Kill the bill. Hashtag kill the bill. And this is the thing that we have to do. And if you're in the UK listening to this now, wherever you are, please raise your voice. If you are in England in particular, but across the UK, raise your voice. Let your voice be heard. Join in to one of these protests if you feel comfortable enough doing so. But if not, and I'd rather recommend that you don't, I would be contacting my member of parliament if I were there. And I really would You know, I would be contacting them. Or even if you can't call them, email them. Tweet them. Write a letter to them. Seek an appointment with them over Zoom, if they do Zoom appointments. I'm not sure if the MPs do. I've not checked. I've not looked. If they do, they have time in their surgeries to do that, in their offices to do that. Some of the MPs are working from their offices. Some are not. You know? So, you know, we still have a pandemic that we're dealing with globally. And on this issue of this bill, which is so draconian in England and the UK overall, please, please, if you believe in freedom, if you believe in the right to peaceful assembly, the right to protest, please, you've got to stand up and join the many hundreds of thousands and millions of people in England and across the United Kingdom who absolutely oppose this dangerous bill. Please, please, write to your member of parliament. Get involved. Those of you in England, please let them know that you want this bill killed and you want your member of parliament to vote against this bill. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of The Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. Dear listener, become a dear subscriber right now to the brand new Politocrat Daily Podcast newsletter. You get benefits for your subscription in this subscription-only newsletter where you must pay in order to get the full benefit of everything. There are no freebies here. But dear listener, you will be glad you subscribed to become a dear subscriber to the Politocrat Daily Podcast newsletter. For your monthly subscription of $5, literally $5 a month, or a yearly subscription of $50, $50 every year, you get exclusive special offers and discounts on all merchandise at the Politocrat Daily Podcast store, and you get a gift mailed to you during the course of a month or a quarter. I'm telling you now, that's just part of your benefit as a subscriber. You get audio extras you will not hear even on the episodes of this daily podcast, the Politocrat Daily Podcast, or anywhere else from yours truly. You'll get news stories that I have discussed and in-depth essays and articles from yours truly, exclusive to subscribers like yourself. Random mailings of free gifts, as I said, and lots, lots more. And by the way, if you become a founding member, your subscription, which would be slightly higher than the yearly subscription, you get to set that price, by the way. You will get 4 books a year mailed to you. 4 books in one calendar year mailed to you. Not all at once, but they'll be mailed to you. And that's what founding members are and mean to me, yours truly, Omar Moore, here at the Politocrat Daily Podcast. And this newsletter is going to knock your socks off. Knock your socks off. Every day you're going to get a newsletter, which makes the price even more of a steal for you. So sign up right now for a paid subscription. It's subscribers only at the Politocrat Daily Podcast newsletter. You will love your benefits. It is definitely worth it. So go now to politocrat.substack.com and thank you for your subscription.